This is High Performance, our gift to you for free every week. This is the podcast that turns the lived experience of the planet's highest performers into your life lessons. So today, allow the greatest leaders, thinkers, sports stars, entertainers, and entrepreneurs to be your teacher. Today, this awaits you.
Do the basics brilliant, and it sounds pathetic, but actually consistently having those really good little preparation tricks in the background. And another great line for them: average is easy, that's why it's popular. It's easy to be average. I think staying present's important. I think, you know, people can take baggage on for the future and really, what's going to happen next November? I'm not sure. Well, I mean, if you give 100% today, you know, you're a good chance it's going to be okay. People talk about sacrifices as a word that I hate. Oh, I made all these sacrifices. Well, you know, for me, it was all upside. You know, people say, you did so well with all these sacrifices. I mean, it's bullshit, because you've got to step up. And this is, you know, for me, it was all like, this is all upside. Every single thing, if I nail this, it's not a sacrifice. It's like, you know, it was just something that needed to be done. So anyway, I went on this training camp and I got smoked. Like, I went at altitude in Austria and like they're skiing and they're doing these walks, and I'm just like, God, these, and all these Europeans are flying. And I'm like, this is never, ever, ever going to happen again, ever in my life, that I'm going to be exposed in something I can control and I can put the work in. And from that day, I just said, you know, bring those type of environments on.
I'm so excited for you to hear this conversation. Mark Webber is today's guest. He was a whisker away from winning the Formula One World Championship in 2010. He's performed at the highest level. He's seen good cultures. He's seen bad cultures. He's been judged from the outside. He's had unbelievable challenges with his teammates and the management of the team that he was racing for. It's a really interesting, really varied, really useful conversation. I think you're going to love it. So thank you so much, Mark, for agreeing to be part of High Performance. Thanks to you, as always, for coming along and enjoying an episode with us. Can I also just say huge thanks as well to everyone that bought tickets for the High Performance 2022 tour last week. We almost sold out in a couple of days. If you want to get your hands on some tickets, I can't promise there are some still available, but if you're in Edinburgh, if you're in London, Manchester or Birmingham and you want to come along and join us, just go to thehighperformancepodcast.com and there may well be some tickets there. But anyway, on with today's episode. A chat with the brilliant Mark Webber comes next. Like a star walking into a movie premiere with paparazzi all over it. I'm definitely not talking about me or Damien. I'm talking about the Lotus Emira V6 first edition, which made an appearance in LA this week in front of some US journalists and influencers, and they absolutely loved the car. If you want to take a look at some images of the Emira, it's Lotus's brand new car coming out in 2022, and you can find it at Lotus Cars across social media or head to lotuscars.com. But don't forget, without our founding partner Lotus Cars, there is no High Performance Podcast. Love you, Lotus.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today on High Performance, we're joined by a multi-time Formula One winner, coming within a whisker of becoming a Formula One world champion. Our guest has won the World Endurance Championship. Yet I think the biggest success is that this man remains as unchanged as the day he left his Aussie town to take on the world, which is quite something when you spent years battling teammates, team bosses and outside perception in the shark-infested waters of Formula One. Mark Webber, welcome to High Performance.
Great to see you guys.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah.
Let's start, as we always begin on this podcast. In your mind, what is high performance?
Massive question, isn't it, mate? I think that you got to be prepared to adapt. Consistency is crucial. You got to always compare yourself to the best, which my dad always said, not the worst. And, you know, you will be stretched. You will be put in deeper waters, and you've got to be able to adapt to reinvent yourself often and then keep that consistency in play. Yeah, I think that's high performance.
It's interesting that you mentioned comparison, because we often try and sort of peddle this belief that comparison is the thief of joy and you shouldn't compare yourself to anyone else. But you say there that actually comparing yourself was a positive thing for you.
I think that early on, yes. I think that Dad instilled that in me in terms of saying, well, look, there's always someone that can have the bar slightly higher. And I think that, you know, and how are they going about that? What are the lessons from that? Is it their environment? Is it their appetite for, you know, filling in the blanks or the weaknesses that we all have in our profession? You know, it's the ones that are phenomenal, mate, which we'll probably get into, you know, the Federers and the Schumachers and the greats of our sports, the Michael Jordans. Obviously, they have an incredible appetite for work, and of course they have the skill to go with it. There's a lot of talented, skillful individuals out there that had exactly that, a lot of talent, but obviously they didn't apply themselves, you know. And I think even as Alex Ferguson, not to quote lots of different people, but I think Fergie said always take work rate over talent, because if the effort's in there, then we can work on the other stuff.
So can I ask you about your parents then, Mark? Because I know you grew up on that, on what was, on, you said was called Straddletown, on the New South Wales and the Canberra border. And you've said yourself you're a bit of a wayward teenager. Can you tell us about how your parents sort of nurtured that talent but also instilled that work ethic in you?
Yeah, I didn't realise how lucky I was to grow up in a really rural setting. You know, Queanbeyan certainly was that. I mean, it wasn't a small town. There's still, you know, 20,000 people there. You know, the old school values are very important to Dad. Simple things like even, you know, finishing a meal at the table. You know, Mum's prepared the food. She's gone to a lot of effort for that. It's important you finish your meal. You know, all these little things and the pleases and thank yous and good handshakes and all those things which were important to Dad. And also, I remember when I did my plumbing apprenticeship, believe it or not, I did that and he's like, well, I want you to do your best, you know, because being a small town, people talk and you know, word gets around if you don't apply yourself properly. So sport, same thing. I did all sports, you know, swimming, tennis, golf, AFL, bit of rugby league. So I think that having the access to all of those sports in a rural area was a real blessing for me, because there was, you know, again, in some rural settings, you can get caught up in some other shenanigans you don't need to be caught up in. So I think that was a nice excuse for me to focus on that. School for me wasn't easy. I was certainly the class clown. I was always up to mischief. I didn't have the attention span to, you know, to close out studies, and I just felt it was, frankly, just incredibly boring. So for me to have sport and then ultimately motorsport was very important for me. When you're exposed to coaches and team environment at a young age, and again, just sort of the opportunity to have some sort of standards, and you have to step up. You know, I think that, you know, you can't have the comfort of mum and dad sort of protecting you and sort of, but a coach would then actually, you know, call out certain issues. And when you're young, it's sort of like learning a language, you know, it just gets hardwired into your head so early that this is what I need to have some level of pride in my work and do the best I can for this team. So I think that those sort of recreational sporting events were very good for me. I wasn't great at all of them. I certainly still enjoy a lot of them to this day, which is good. Another small example, I mean, the Canberra Raiders, the football team, was quite close to us, and a friend of ours called David Ferner lived in the same street, and just saw David, the work that he put in. And Dad, you know, whether it was intentional or not, but he'd show me David going to train on his own, pulling tractor tires around fields, you know, getting his strength up, and just like, yeah, it was a real eye-opener to see what it actually takes. You know, you're so naive at a young age to think what a sports person needs to go through to hit the heady heights. But I think to have that put into me at an early age was very, very fortunate.
So was there a specific incident with a coach that still sticks in your mind that you were still using when you were at the peak of your powers in Formula One?
Coaching wise, I think in those sort of sports, probably not so much, but I think that certainly in racing, I think when I got into the junior scene, the accountability on you, you know, in terms of simple things, you know, timekeeping. That was a big one, which I learned some hard lessons on early on. Like, and my dad was big on that, but it's actually, that was a huge thing about being punctual with your timekeeping, you know, because there's a lot of other people that, you know, when you turn up for something, 5 minutes early is on time, or 10 minutes early is on time. So all those little things, you get a lot of very, very quick feedback early on how those things should be, you know, executed. And then just that team environment. I think when you start to bridge out into a bigger environment of team in motorsport, for example, you really have, you know, you've got the mechanics, you've got everyone that you start to, holy, you know, I'm the arrowhead here. I'm the guy that's going to actually start driving this vehicle to the best of its ability. But they've got, you know, so many other facets that they're focusing on. And it's not just about, you are really giving them the confidence to do the work to the best of their ability as well, because the buy-in is so big at that point. Yeah. They believe that you can do the job.
And how big is control then for you when you start to get those opportunities in your early years of motorsport? Because I think that sometimes the power of seeing someone dragging a tyre around a field is a reminder from your dad that there'll be lots of things out of your control. Mm. But the one thing that you are able to control is your work ethic. It is your mindset. It is your self-belief. So were you rock solid at the age of 17, 18, 19? Or were you still, like a lot of people at that age, racked with self-doubt as you were trying to make your way into motorsport?
At that age, what I struggle with, and I think probably a lot of other sports men and women do when they're on that journey, is what is the bar? Where's the high point of what you're supposed to be doing at that particular time in your career? You know, I remember when I first signed for Mercedes-Benz as a professional, so I'm now on, you know, 150,000 German Deutschmarks, which is whatever, 30, 40, you know, grand a year, which is like, this is just unbelievable. I'm now getting paid to do my job. And it was nearly a line that came out, like, I've inside the house, like, I've made it, you know. And Anne and Dad quickly was like, you have done fuck all, mate, at the moment. Like, this is not even, you know, this is, you haven't even started. So anyway, I went on this training camp and I got smoked. Like, I went at altitude in Austria and, like, they're skiing and they're doing these walks and I'm just like, God, these, and all these Europeans are flying. And I'm like, this is never, ever, ever going to happen again, ever in my life, that I'm going to be exposed in something I can control and I can put the work in. And from that day, I just said, you know, bring those type of environments on, because that's something that I just loved, you know, preparing myself day in, day out for the gaps where I wasn't the most skillful behind the wheel in many instances. But in terms of my fitness levels, I was never going to be caught out with that side of it. So that was a big gear change for me in terms of being caught out, exposed, one of the slowest, one of the weakest, diet wasn't great.
So it was a good thing.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. You know, and Tony Mattes was a doctor then, you know, Austrian guy. He's a bit of a, went in your eye, this guy's a lunatic. He's absolutely crazy what he wants us to do. But actually, you look back, it's like, it was completely normal and fair.
But can I take you to that moment where you felt exposed, where you come in last?
Mm.
Because at that moment, it's almost a crucible. You could either decide that this isn't for me, this, I'm miles away from it, and I'll never make it.
Yep.
But you obviously had this idea of, I'm going to bridge that gap, I'll never be caught out again.
Yep.
Where does that come from?
I think it's the pride, mate. For me at that time, it was like, I felt embarrassed in myself. I've come all this way. It's a long way to go back to Australia with your tail between your legs. And it's like, I haven't even sort of got started yet. This is like, if you want to be professional, this is a part that you need to start getting your head around, Mark, you know, get your finger out. You're absolutely kidding yourself if you think you can take shortcuts on that stuff. Because the bloke in the mirror, you know, it's like the old Wayne Bennett, the famous rugby league coach in Australia, the old man in the mirror. If you're bullshitting him, you're in serious strife.
So you work now with a lot of young racing drivers, right? Mm. How do you help to instill resilience into them? Because I think that what a lot of people would do is go on that fitness camp, go, oh my goodness, it's not for me after all. I'm just going to head back to Australia and carry on with the plumbing, which is the backup plan.
Yeah.
What do you say to these young guys that have a struggle?
It's part of the test, Jake, I think. You can counsel, you can, I think, try and give support, and naturally I do, and I find that enjoyable. But ultimately, you know, it's the old thing, you can't take a horse to water, right? You've got to have a couple of flash points, which I did, and it's like, you've got to take the lead, because obviously if it's inside, that'll then be consistent and it'll burn away correctly and it'll be sustainable. But if you've got these, you know, peaks and valleys of actually motive, I'm going to be on that, and this was embarrassing, and, you know, and I want to actually start and turn it into a bit of, like, the competition factor. It's like, it's not only that. When I go there, I want to pulverize these guys. I actually want to, you know, turn the embarrassment the other way. You know, it's actually start getting the word out that actually, Jesus, you know, he's absolutely on the case. So that's, if you can instill that in them, there's a lot of ownership on them, because you can give them a bit, but ultimately, you know, you can't, you know, they've got to get on the bike, they've got to go altitude and skiing, they've got to start getting themselves physically prepared. The diet, the discipline around diet, you know, to stay lean for 11 months of the year. You know, you can't, you know, sit there with a spoon and, you know, feed these kids. They've got to actually do it themselves and make selections and choices.
So what kind of changes did you make then to then make that transition from where you were to where you wanted to be?
Well, the changes were the level of consistency, diet, fitness. I actually quite enjoyed, in the end, training on my own, because then again, I had no excuses. I didn't want to take any liabilities out with me in terms of, you know, training and saying, well, someone's quicker, someone's slower, whatever. I just knew that I had to continue to get fitter myself, and also then take good counsel and seek good advice off, for example, you know, some some guys from the military, which was great for me at the time, a few mates in the Special Forces, which was just a complete fluke. I come across them at the right time, because that's what life can often be. It's like time, it's just meant to be. And then the standards just went from, okay, this is an eye-opener, this is where I need to be. And, you know, they needed to also apply themselves in that situation, because obviously they're in a completely different situation. While I was doing sport, it was, you know, it's not as big a deal as, you know, obviously fighting for your country. So that was a great eye-opener. And they gave me access into lots of different sports, you know, to get myself strong enough. You know, I'm tall. My lower back was always exposed in a Formula One car. So get my back strong, getting my glutes, you know, cycling, you know, all the running, all, you know, swimming, you know, hydrotherapy, all those things, which, you know, at the time was just an education process. But I just loved all of it. I just took it all in, and it probably went back to my early childhood, because that was the segue into, like, all of these sports weren't an issue for me in terms of, you know, coordination and, yeah, you know, getting myself into them. It was just I needed to actually do them more often and more intense.
As you know, because you've listened to a few of these podcasts, yep, this isn't really a conversation about Formula One, is it? Mm-hmm. It's a conversation about life. So
that's good to hear, Jake, yeah.
The military yep, conversations that you had, what was the advice they gave you for people listening to this thinking, yeah, I'm kind of similar, I'm struggling a bit with motivation or with discipline or with consistency? Mm. What did you see in that military world where you were like, wow?
Well, mate, ownership, planning, you know, they plan very well, like just simple things, you know, like my buddy 20 years ago, he just said, mate, get your gear out the night before, you know, your running gear, anything you're going to do in the next morning when you wake up, because we're all brilliant at, you know, it's cold outside, it is what it is, whatever. But if you get your gear out the night before, it's beside your bed or wherever it needs to be, you're out, it's on, and that's 80, in my head, it was actually nearly 80% of actually, once I'm out the door, we're on.
Yeah.
You know, but to get your ass out the door. So all those little tricks.
World-class basics.
Yeah, exactly. Do the basics brilliant, yeah, and you're, you know, I mean, it sounds pathetic, but actually consistently having those really good little preparation tricks in the background. And another great line for them, average is easy, that's why it's popular. It's easy to be average. You know, so, but things like that. So,
because
yeah,
people
so,
think, they look at you and go, oh, Formula One driver, won 9 Grand Prix, world endurance champion, he must be doing things that are so far ahead of where I'm living my life, I can't possibly get to that mm-hmm. level. But that's why we have these conversations, because you weren't suddenly doing things that are totally alien to 90% of the population. You're doing things that almost anyone listening to this can do if yep. if in their own world yep. they want to be world class.
It is simple things, mate. They just, yeah. you know, and cut the surprises out. You know, if you see it coming and pick it off, and if you're just in control, just organized, whether it's sport or in your personal life, you're a bit more of a chance.
Why is consistency so important? You've mentioned that word 4 or 5 times already.
Yeah. Well, I think you've got to be dependable and reliable. I think that you're, you know, if you're really up and down, you know, you can be tricky to work with. And I think if you get that level of consistency to a higher level, then you can actually, the gains actually, you can start to work out on your gains a bit easier. But if you're working off a smaller platform yeah. of high points, it's hard to, you know, nudge away at the at you achieving, you know, higher levels of performance. So if you're more consistent, naturally, I think you're just nudging that bar up in a more of an even fashion. Instead of you being all over the show, it's harder for you to, you know, increase your performance.
And it sounds in many ways that when you describe it like that, that leads to higher levels of trust mm. from the people that work with you, because they know what they're going to get.
Mm.
So would you tell us about trusting the cultures when you went into Formula One?
People don't realise the size maybe of the Formula One teams. Like, it when I was at Red Bull Racing, there's probably, well, now there's around 1,000 people employed in that operation. And you know, we're talking 300 to 400 million euro budgets to operate 2 cars, which is just, you know, absolutely extraordinary. Not in football terms, it's not, but in terms of, you know, or global, many other global sports, but Formula One's certainly up there. But the consequences are, you know, if we don't have that level of trust, you know, there's certain members of the Red Bull team that I would have beside my mum's bed at hospital if she's in strife. You know, like, that's the level of trust you have in these guys, because it's just that, you know, we don't even hardly have to talk to them each day. You know, it's just that communication of, mate, we're good to go. And as you say, that meticulous preparation on the consistency front. So I haven't had any issues for ages, because over time that builds your trust, because it's like, hey, the car's been whatever, I haven't been blindsided by an issue, I'm driving it, and it's like, well, these guys have, this thing's buttoned down, I've got a lot of trust in it, I can, of course, we within 8 or 10 seconds we're pushing that car to its limits. So there has to be a huge element of trust. the sleep deprivation, these guys will work, and girls, they'll work for, you know, when they used to. Now there's curfews and stuff, but the amount of time and effort they would put into that car for you to be able to go out, and it was just such a love affair, which was a beautiful feeling.
And how much time would you spend developing that then? Because it sounds like a brilliant end product, but again, for people listening to this that say, I'd love that in my workplace or with my team.
Yeah, of course, it takes time. You know, there can be challenges, absolutely, around, because everyone's different and they go around their job in different sort of ways. And even if it's culturally Formula One, look, we've got Italian, Spanish, Australian, South Africans, English. So you've got the, you know, different nuances with cultures, and you've got to work your way through that. But ultimately, when you find the right people, which does take time, you're right. I found myself at the end of my career, if you're looking at your clock and you're sort of like, you know, we can get away a bit early and we can, you know, today's not for me, or getting a bit late, they're not the characters that you're after. You're after the ones that want to do, you know, not inefficient work, but the extra mile on your program. We just got this common cause performance, and making sure that with the opposition, we're giving ourselves the absolute best chance to beat everyone else. Because if you start undercooking or being, you know, cavalier to the opposition, then of course you're on a hiding to nothing.
What were you like then with people that you didn't feel were at the level you wanted to be? And I'm interested in kind of how you learned to deal with them, because I'd imagine early on you maybe went a bit far and then learned how to share your point of view in a way that was helpful.
Yeah, you're right, Jake. I think that you have to learn how to communicate well, as you say. Like, sometimes I was not great with that. If someone wasn't, you know, if I saw someone as a bit of driftwood or wasn't really contributing to the program, I wouldn't communicate that well with them. I would sort of freeze them out early on. You know, right. It's like, well, I'm not getting much from that, so I'm not going to put much in it, which was wrong. You know, that was like in the early part of my career. But in this, like, you've got to go, do you go directly to them? Do you go a bit higher up and say, well, you know, he or she, I'm not really feeling the intensity here or the drive or the love for what we're doing. And why is that? Do we need to, you know, dig into it a little bit more? And naturally, you'll find that there could be some reasons, but also there can be people that just, that's them topped out. That's them done. They are, that's them at 100% full noise, and they can't contribute anymore, and they might not survive in that role. Because actually, and that's where motorsport and hopefully sport is pretty handy, that if someone is a bit subpar, you can move them on. Because, you know, it's like, it has to be like that. You know, if we can find someone that can do a better job, that will bring us more performance. And look, some people are, you know, tucked in the corner. You know, we've got a lot of, you know, scientific and you can borderline nerds in the background, and they're not great communicators, but do they bring a lot to the program? Well, they are phenomenal individuals, you know, when it comes to the engineering component. So you've got to be careful, because you've got some characters that glue the team together, and you need that banter.
Not everyone can be like you.
Of course, yeah.
But they still bring their...
Mate, of course. But you've got to have that fun culture too, in a way. You know, you can't just have a sterile environment where it's just like, this is Groundhog Day every day. You've got to have, you know, why are we here? What are we achieving today? Clear goals about, you know, what's got to be achieved today, or, you know, the 3 month or 6 month or the year, you know, the holistic, you know, plan of the program. But day to day, you've got to have an enjoyable environment. Naturally, you've got to have that. You got to have that fun. And there'll be a couple of characters in there that help that glue, of course. You know, there's going to be somebody pull back out and, oh God, we miss them for, you know. So everyone has got, you know, a critical role to play in a big operation like that.
Let's talk then about environments and cultures. I remember in your book, you said that it's very rare to find someone that really loved driving for Williams, for example, and you were the same. You struggled at Williams, right?
Yep.
Culturally.
Yep.
So when you arrived there, what was it about that team that just didn't light your fire?
I mean, it was a dream for mine to drive for Williams. It was a huge name, and still is to this day. And I was at Jaguar at the time. I drove for them in 03 and 04. And McLaren was sniffing around a little bit at the time, but that went away a bit earlier than what Renault and Williams did. They were still at the table at the end. And I went to Williams, and it was just, I just felt it wasn't overly warm. And I don't need to be overly loved, but I just felt this is actually a pretty, you know, pretty cold environment. And the driver was certainly just a small part of this whole operation, which is certainly, you know, is the case in many ways. But you just sort of felt that the first day should have been like, mate, I was so excited. But it was okay, but it wasn't like, my God, I don't feel overly, you know, accepted or loved, and I'm a key member of this whole going forward of this operation. It was like, you're pretty, you know, interchangeable, you know, pretty quickly. So that was like hit me pretty hard. I'm like, okay, this is going to be
different.
Was that
just from the impression you got, or was that quite overt?
I think it was real.
Yeah.
I think it was, you know, and I enjoyed a good relation with Frank, you know, more probably privately than professionally, and also with Patrick Head and the bosses there. And Claire Williams, who was Frank's daughter, was my press manager at the time. So that was all fine, I think, Monday to Friday. But when it came to actually the sort of racing component and professionally working for the team, it was just something that I didn't sort of, it was very, very, I don't know, I'm married to an English lady, but it was very, very English in terms of it sort of was just a sort of stoic, you know, upper lip and stiff upper lip. And
so what were they lacking then, like an embrace or a night out or a bit of love or togetherness?
I think that freshness of people, I think, you know, living in the past a bit too, you know, that was something which was, you know, it's easy to look in the mirrors a lot instead of that it doesn't do you any favours whatsoever. I think that, you know, going forward and focus on what's coming at you was important. So dining out on the past was something which was maybe not that positive. And that come from, you know, people continuing to have their jobs there that maybe was probably outstayed their welcome. So I think that fresh enthusiasm and excitement and love for what people were doing, because they had done so much winning, and now they're sort of mid-table.
Yeah.
And people were like, and the mid-table atmosphere was like within the company. It's like, well, how are we going to get ourselves? Because they've had so much champagne, these guys. The whole company had so much success for so long, and now they're trying to get themselves out of this. And it's like, oh, here's another driver. Who's like, you know, it's like, it's just another. And the churn was actually probably needed to be higher in a different way in terms of the sort of recruiting process was just culturally.
Did you try and change this? Did you sort of take it upon yourself to go, listen, guys, I see issues here.
Yeah.
Let's work on them.
Yeah. So I did. Sam Michael was there at the time. He was a head technical director, Australian guy. So again, I thought that was going to be pretty useful in terms of culturally trying to help what we might need to do. But it was very draining, very draining. And I remember, you know, one day mowing the lawns, and I'm just trying to say, if this is how the best team operates, then, wow, this is going to be – I'm in the middle of my career. I've got a long slog to, you know, continue to enjoy this type of work, because I didn't really see it like this. So, mate, it was draining. And in the end, I pretty much had made my decision, you know, through that fight, a two-year contract, and I pretty much made the end of that first year. And, like, I need to – probably, if it's like this, it's either stopping or I've got to find a different environment. Because what we thought at the time was average performance, we're still getting a few podiums and it was average. And then from even the years after that, it got worse and worse and worse and worse from a results perspective for Williams. So I think what they thought was average at that time was, little did we know, they were going to the back of the grid, like last row in the next 5 or 6 years.
So taking your dad's philosophy of comparing yourself to the best, what did you do to recognise that what was going on wasn't just the gut instincts of mediocrity, but you could see better examples elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty inexperienced still at the time, mate, to be honest. You know, I knew where I'd come from was a better working relationship, but they hadn't had the results that Williams had had. So I'm saying, what is right here? What is normal? We can have a cushy, you know, environment where everyone's, you know, high-fiving each other and it's all, you know, honky-dory, but it's like but there's no trophies coming in. So where's this sweet spot? It's not until I found out, I suppose, you know, with moving to another team after that, whether it being Red Bull and then working with people like David Coulthard and Adrian Newey and that type of environment, where I saw that, you know, continuing to push the boundaries and, again, you know, not in some ways not comparing yourself to the best or having bringing the competition on. We want to be tested because we enjoy being a bit exposed sometimes, and let's bring everyone to the table, because that will keep everyone else on their toes in our operation, which was a little bit like Adrian was always, you know, one of the best engineers in the world. He was like, bring them on because we're ready for them, which was an interesting, you know, psychological approach that wasn't like that at Williams. So Dad's philosophy, and like you say, compare yourself to the best at that time, for me, I was struggling to see, you know, the wood from the trees in terms of, like, how are we going to get out of this? Because I thought this was the best, but it's still, we're not getting the results at the moment, so we needed to change.
And didn't they call you in one day to basically tell you that they weren't happy with you? And I just wonder, you're looking at them thinking, you're not a great team, and then suddenly they tell you you're not good enough for us. Almost,
yeah.
How I mean, maybe tell us the story of what happened in that meeting and how that sat with you mentally.
Yeah, it was at the start of, we traditionally Formula One has a 3-week break in August, in which we have a bit of downtime. Frank had called me down there and Patrick for a meeting at 8 o'clock on the Monday morning of the 3-week break. Okay, this is a bit different. First year here, and so called me down and just said, yeah, just how disappointed they were with my performances, and you know, if we could get out of your contract now, we would. 2 years is we don't need this anymore, and you know. And I remember ringing Annie coming back, and I'm just like, poof. Yeah, that was a bit blindsided by that, just sort of thing. Well, actually, the car's been pretty unreliable, and we've been in some pretty decent results positions, you know, at the back end of the Grand Prix, and the car had failed on me.
Did you say that to them?
Yeah, of course. It was certainly two against one, and yeah. I was respecting my, as best I could, you know, the establishment and the future with the team. And I'm saying, guys, you know, like, I'm trying to table some of the challenges we got here and how thin, actually, what I knew that at the time, you know, some of our technical people were so thin in terms of mopping up some of the gaps, and you could see where, in my opinion, where some of the issues were coming from. But anyway, that was just another little, it's like, I don't feel that this is the place for me.
So in the best teams you've worked with, and then comparing it, so how much of the focus was on the engineering side of it, and how much was on the human side of it?
Well, I think that what was important when I went to Red Bull Racing then was the orientation around goals is very clear. We're here to win. If you want to be in this program, this is what we're going to do, and we want to go on, we're going to win world championships. And then when you hire the best in the world in key departments, then your recruiting becomes easier, but then you have to deliver. My God, you have to deliver, you know, because it's like, we've got everything sorted out. And obviously the boss of Red Bull, Dietrich Mateschitz, he did. It's like, you know, there's no excuses now. We have got the Adrian Newey's, we've got, you know, the best people in all the positions. We've got the fastest pit stops in the world, which took time. You know, that took a lot of time. But Red Bull Racing still to this day are intimidating in the pit lane. Not many teams want to take them on in the pit lane. And that takes 1,000 pit stops practice a year, probably at the factory. And those guys want to be on that car at that time because they want the pressure and the accountability of making sure that pit stop goes smooth. And that sound, again, it's the big little things. It's 1.8 seconds or 2 seconds. But if you get it wrong, you know, it's not a great moment to tell the grandkids, you know.
But what I mean though, Mark, is that it sounds like that experience where you've got called into that meeting at Williams is quite cold and clinical as opposed to sort of picking your brains and understanding how are you feeling about this and what can we get to get you to perform better. Yep.
But it's 16 years ago too now, you know, so things have changed. And I was reasonably thick-skinned to, you know, I was happy to take stuff on the chin and work out where I could be better. But that was a very, you know, it was a older establishment. But then when you went to a much younger team, younger outfit, I think that there was that side of, you know, we had a female member at Red Bull who was head of HR, and she was like so good at getting the best out of the guys, because the guys are pretty useless at talking to blokes. Whatever they paid her, it probably wasn't enough, because she probably over time, she did probably pretty well for just getting a bit more out of the guys that they might not find comfortable talking about to a male colleague.
So you've arrived at Red Bull, you've had your time at Williams, you're hunting that first win in Formula One. Mm-hmm. You're hungry for it. You've had to go through all sorts of battles to get to Formula One in the first place. And then you realise that it's not as pure as just driving a car, and that it gets political and you're a pawn in the game. I mean, I remember one of the team bosses in my first year in Formula One saying, do you want to come and meet the light bulb? And I said, how do you mean? And he goes, well, that's the driver. Like, as soon as he goes out, we'll screw another one in.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting position then to be in, isn't it? Because when you're a driver in Formula One, you're everything and nothing. Mm-hmm. You're right at the centre of it, but they can just remove you and there is someone else. Well, there's a queue of them waiting to do it. Do you remember when you first became aware of that side of Formula One? I guess it probably was at Red Bull that the political element of being a Formula One driver came to the fore.
Yeah, I think middle of the field there is some politics, but when you're at the front going for Grand Prix victories and World Championships, it does become a little bit more prevalent in terms of the what's at stake in terms of, you know, some of the politics around that, and they could be good for you as well, like equipment and engines and, you know, rules and, you know, so it, you know, Red Bull or any team, you know, we've got two teams. So you could say, well, that's political because they've got two teams on the field and they've got more votes. And, you know, so it's like, I would benefit from that. And when it comes to, you know, some of your press positions or your statements, it's like, mate, don't go down that alley because we're doing something else further down the road, which would be assistance to everything else. So you got to navigate your way through all of those things, whether it's stuff that gets in the public or stuff that...
Were you equipped for that? Yeah. Were you for that side of the job?
Well, you got to learn fast, mate. Yeah, and obviously I wasn't overly PC, so that was sometimes probably wasn't great for me in that sport. I could have been probably a little bit more... smoother on basically keeping people happier longer, or you know, putting more effort into the relationships that I found a bit shallow. It's like, well, this is just not, it's not my type of people, and I'm not going to put the relationship in there. And that was something that I probably could have been better at, but I still to this day feel happy with that's how I handle it, because that's what type of guy I am. There's a lot at stake here, and you sort of find out that we're right at the arrowhead of this juggernaut of a business. It is huge, and you are not a light bulb, but you are nearly a light bulb, mate.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, I just want to talk to you very briefly about what I believe to be a total revolution in sleep, and it's called 8Sleep. It's a pod cover that goes on the mattress that's currently on your bed, and it controls the temperature to suit you perfectly. And it all works from this app. Me and my wife, we like different temperatures. I actually like my side of the bed cooler. But the 8Sleep isn't just about the temperature. It's your own personal sleep coach. I get a sleep fitness score. I can find out more about the quality of my sleep, the kind of routine that I'm in. But it also gives me the different sleep stages as well, so I can find out how much REM sleep or deep sleep I'm getting. And then I can tailor things in my own life, like alcohol or coffee before bed or when I work out, to try and improve my sleep. And we all know that sleep is the foundation of high performance. If we can improve our sleep, we can improve so much of our life. It's time to bring tech to the bedroom by going to 8sleep.com/HPP, where you can get £200 off your pod and free shipping. That's 8sleep.com/HPP.
Today's show is brought to you in association with Mindlift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So Mindlift is neuroscience based. And what I love about Mindlift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out Mindlift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So Mindlift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
So when you do things like, did you say, good job we're not designing planes or something about the Red Bull earlier?
We don't design helicopters,
Because it kept breaking down, and you were basically insinuating if this was a helicopter that broke down, it would be a serious problem.
Yeah.
How did that kind of thing get dealt with internally?
With racing drivers, adrenaline, obviously, it's very, very high, obviously, when driving the cars. And there's a lot of things that we say, of course, in the heat of the moment, which you like, you know, and there's the list goes on. All of us guys that had long careers, that you could pull out a catalogue of punchy statements on the radio, which you probably might not have foreseen being the best thing to say at that time. But it's just... if you put so much in, and you can see that other teams, in this case, for example, if other teams are super reliable and again, back to that word consistent, and then you've got a car that is incredibly unreliable and not dangerous, but, you know, parts failing and things like this, it's like, well, yeah, you know, and because I know a little bit about aviation, it's like, well, you know, how do we get it right in aviation, but in this stuff we can't, because obviously these are virtually prototype cars anyway, and there's a lot more, risk in design and concept, of course. But yeah, so there has been absolutely several moments where I've been hard on staff, or you've called someone out, and sometimes it can be irreparable. Sometimes the relationships, it can be really cutting, and it might not have gone down well. But you could get called in on something like that, and just say, look, mate, you know, that's obviously that one line has affected 300 people, and that wasn't clever. You know, so then you've got obviously a retracting sort of, you know, because of course when you're in the car, as I say, you say things which you know, you get the frustration levels. It's that,
but it's from a desire to win, though, isn't it? That's the,
of course, and you have this flash moment of whether it's a, you know, 50-50 tackle, you know, whether it's, you know, we see it in football, don't we? You know, guys just have this rash decision, just rush of blood, and in our turn, we can't do that. We can't move an inch. We're strapped into that car. The only thing we can talk. We can just shout something out random, which we often do.
So would you give us an example of a specific time where you'd said something that, in hindsight, you were sorry you'd said it, and how did you repair it?
Yeah, it would have been definitely at a mechanic or something around, you know, pit stops, or you know, personally calling someone out for being, you know, massively subpar.
Right.
And you can be hastily in that after a race, and you can go and find them and you can call them out, and obviously, and then of course you get to it and you work out that there's always a little bit of a background to why that was a sub poor performance, or something happened for them on that day for that to have happened. So yeah, of course you cool down. There is a cooling down period, and you know, but as long as it's, you know, not a repeated, you know.
Yeah.
You can live with it, you know, if it's a one-off, you know, and you're just like, yeah, you know, sometimes it's the other way, you know, you go in there and you're like saying, guys, you give an encouragement, you know, if someone actually has a weirdly abnormal mistake or something, you're like, that's unlike him or unlike her, that's really strange, and then it's like, you know, and then you would go to them, and I would see that as an opportunity to absolutely give encouragement that, right. You know, if the consistency has been phenomenal and you have this little wobble, go there and say, look, got your back. All good. Well, yeah, the form card's phenomenal. All good. And, you know, and give them the, you know, because again, why? Because they're so, they've got so much pride in their work, you know, and for them to have a wobble is, it hurts them, you know, and they're the characters you want.
There's something magical, though, from the outside looking in at the Red Bull culture. Like, we were all quite jealous of it because it looked like everyone was having a party. It was brilliant all the time. I know, and we can probably talk about them. There are some elements of it that are not fantastic, but there was something that they did that was totally different to the rest of the whole Formula One paddock. And I just wonder what it was like being involved in that culture of the whole Red Bull brand, and how much that was kind of inspiring for you to see someone like Dietrich Mateschitz is a great example. Look what he's built, that empire that he's created at Red Bull. For you to see that and to feel you're part of it.
I think the freshness, mate, the freshness was great. I think there was one year, I mean, this is probably going to be a horrendous misquote, but there was something around the amount of tens of thousands of hours that were done, extra hours in one year, unpaid. So people didn't get paid for that work, but they just loved their work, and they loved going to work, and they loved, you know, because we were the underdogs initially, as you know, mate, and we wanted to, you know, ruffle some feathers, and that was the attitude within the team. We are going to ultimately, at some point, we're going to beat all these guys, Ferrari, all these huge names, and that was where the spring and the step come from, because we're like, okay, and that was the recruitment, and that was like, you know, this is the goal, and these are the individuals we want, and the mean line of the age was pretty low, I think, in terms of, you know, so the trust. And then in building that belief with inside those young individuals was great. But you're right, mate, from the top, you know, Dietrich would come to one race a year probably, so not many. But I think just, you know, under the, you know, for example, like Jonathan Wheatley, who's the team manager doing all the pit stops and sort of, you know, he's, you know, the standards with inside the car preparation. And sometimes I'd come back, my wife's a Manchester United fan, so we go at Old Trafford and we're driving home, and I'd, you know, super late, and I'd get some takeaway pizzas, 30 takeaway pizzas or 20 takeaway pizzas. And January and February is when they're racing, they're getting their cars ready for the new season. I'd go in, and to have, at the time, probably one of the highest paid members of staff, but coming with the pizzas and just said that, Colt, mate, I didn't see it. It wasn't like, you know, I'm better than them. These guys are the absolute warriors of our team. They're at 1 o'clock in the morning preparing these cars, go in, and just they come alive. You know, it was just brilliant for me. And I left there, and Anne said, you could hardly sleep coming back to saying that they're up there preparing these cars with meticulous passion and enthusiasm, and the buy-in from home too, mate. You know, like, is obviously, you know, often, of course, they're all in, you know, relationships, and you know that this is, there's a lot of trust and buy-in at home on them working those sort of hours. So that was extremely enjoyable. Something I've never really, well, I have sort of experienced since, but when you get that level of trust inside a team, it's fantastic.
So when you go in and you see these guys sort of working in the wee small hours, and did it add to the weight of responsibility that you had as the arrowhead of the team, or did it inspire you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I know this is a line that's been used in from other sports people, but you know, the pressure is the privilege. Obviously, it's sort of like, you know, when you turn up and you know, you walk into the garage, so I've seen the journey this car's gone on, and the deadlines and the hours that it's gone into it, and you roll down the pit lane for the first time, and this is, God knows how many pieces are in an F1 car. I'm not even going to try and guess how many thousands of pieces, but this, the timeline of all these things arriving at the same time, pretty much within a day, to then for us to drive the next day. And they're all waiting. They're hanging on every word. They're just waiting for what you want to say about it and what can we do to improve it. They're already, you know, frothing to say, okay, what can we do to improve? You know, he's going to have some feedback. It's not going to be perfect out of the box. What can we improve? How's the seat? How's the seat belts? How's the aerodynamics? What are the brakes like? What's the electronics like? You know, what have we got here? What's your view like? Where's the little windscreen? What's the steering? You got all, and it's just like a flood of information. You got these people coming in to try and make your job better, because obviously if you're more comfortable and you can give a better performance, of course it's a reflection of their efforts.
And what did that period teach you about communication? So for people listening to this that are not in Formula One, but actually it makes no odds what sport or business you're in, getting the answers to those questions is what every business wants, to be faster and better. And you're involved in other businesses now. So what were your lessons in strong, powerful communication from the Formula One years?
Yeah, I think obviously transparency is as fast and as quick as it can be to have the correct lines of communication through to then...
So would you just give total honesty, even if it was a painful thing for someone to hear, because that's kind of what you have to do?
Yes. Or? I mean, yes, if you can. I mean, there might be a way to soften the blow to try and give the encouragement or you know, not, you know, clip their wings too hard and demotivate them. But finding that the right way to communicate through the right channels, because obviously, again, it can get, you know, stories can change through big companies. It's like, well, there's, you know, and it can be interpreted in different ways. So you've got to be really mindful of that, I think. But I think, yeah, I think having that ability to get into the right channels and know it's going to be spread into the right individuals in the right way, and that again is down to culture, isn't it? The trust of the people underneath. I'm not saying, you know, God, I'm not the boss, but you're saying, you know, as a driver, because they can take it personal, of course. You know, if you are attacking a part of the business, whether it's in as you mentioned here, mate, whether it's marketing or whether it's, you know, budget control or whether it's whatever it is, social media, whatever, if someone has a negative opinion on how it's the trajectory looks, then of course that individual naturally can often take it as a bit of an uppercut. But if you take it as, it's a two-way street here, you know, what, please, let's, both of us, what can I do to make your job easier? You know, how can I continue to strive forward? And I think that's, transparency is important. Yeah. Deal with it quickly. I mean, you don't let things fester. Gut feel is always pretty big. Gut feel is massive. I think that that's one of my biggest lessons is gut feel is generally been pretty right.
So what is the best piece of feedback that you've ever given and received that's made the biggest difference to
you? You never know who's watching. There's always someone watching that you might not know is watching, or watching your attitude or how you behave, that can have an influence, or you can influence them, or it's the positive effect on your attitude day to day, because you're always sort of like, when I was racing, but you know, this individual said you're sort of now, you're always on show in a way, you know, and you've got to really respect that and make sure that you are respectful of how you are behaving, because people will draw conclusions pretty quickly, so you're in control of all of those things. So, and for me, the best advice that I gave, I think being true to yourself is important. I think you can, you know, it's very easy now with, you know, with all this social media stuff and, you know, this, you know, shallow settings that we can have, and the delusional fact of where you think you are mentally or what you're up to. The accountability, control in yourself is important, and you've got to take ownership and really, where you can, surround yourself with people that are on your journey, and have that belief in you, and yes, put you in deep water every now and again, because you need to be put out of our comfort zone. You know, if you just don't want to, if you just want to cruise around, you know, I know you've had Ian Thorpe on here, mate, but if Thorpe, he just cruised around in the shallow end his whole life, Ian, he wouldn't have the career that he had. So I think that, you know, being happy to take the deeper waters when you can with the right people around you, and stay present. I think staying present is important. I think, you know, people can take baggage on for the future and really, oh, what's going to happen next November? I'm not sure. Well, I mean, if you give 100% today, you know, you're a good chance it's going to be okay.
What's the challenge, though, when you're living in the present is all of the stuff surrounding a Formula One driver in the team, though. I mean, Red Bull was a brilliant period for you. That's where all your wins came. You were at the absolute top of your game and there was great stuff there. The challenge was your teammate, Sebastian Vettel. Mm-hmm. Can you take us inside what it's like to be in the same team? Everyone's pulling in the same direction, but you are absolutely the most direct competitor of the person who's in the team alongside you. And just how you deal with that, because it's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost unique to Formula One, isn't it?
Yeah, horrible, Jake, actually, because I think it's better to have a competitor in another team than obviously if you both of you are firing pretty well. And it was uncharted waters for Red Bull. It's the first time, you know, we'd ever been through it. Yes, individuals had been, you know, in terms of we had, you know, obviously phenomenal individuals in the team that had seen this play out in other teams, but it's the first time that we had to deal with it in our own team, and the first time for me and the first time for Sebastian. So both as drivers, we were both going for our first world title in 2010. So really, really challenging from a management perspective, because you get divide within the organization. It's just really hard for them to contribute evenly across both sides. And keep in mind, we had just two small characters like Lewis Hamilton and Alonso also in the fight. So they weren't, you know, easy to handle either. So managing the individuals on what you saw their team and our team, you know, it shouldn't be like that. But yeah, as you're saying, it becomes like that. And when you're getting right to the end of a championship, you start to see shadows. You start to see, you know, is he with me or is he not with me? You know, is she with me or what, you know, where are their loyalties really? You know, it really
comes
down to
you talk about other members of the team.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Right. Other members. Are they neutral? Are they really neutral or is there a bit of a bias? Because personally, mate, it's just human fact that we have biases. We have favourites. This is how we are. You know, we just do gravitate to one or the other in some way. So the challenging thing, obviously, a bit with Seb was obviously, you know, he was funded by Red Bull from an early age and I wasn't. I was an old dog that was helping the team out at a point where it was like, maybe was I a little bit inconvenient to fighting for that world title? This wasn't really what the playbook was supposed to look like. So that's the crash course on that, in terms of how I went deep into the championship. We took it to the last race, as you know. But I think that in the team, keeping the glue of the operation together was certainly extremely challenging.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of lessons from that. And there was some blowback. There were some people that left, you know, people that weren't happy with some of how the things were handled. And tensions went, you know, very, very high.
I mean, I think for people that are listening to this that are not Formula One aficionados, right? Let's just make it clear the sort of things that were going on. I mean, a member of the engine department told you that when you're behind Sebastian, the engines get turned down, mm-hmm. right? So you can't have a crack at yeah. him. You only communicate really with your own engineer on the pit wall, Kyron it was, who yep. worked with you. And mm-hmm. you ended up talking in code so that if it was a message from the team, you knew it wasn't that's true, isn't it?
Yeah,
you knew it wasn't a message from Kyron.
Yeah.
In other words, if it was like a team order, he didn't want to be the one to deliver that message. Sebastian had what he believed was a cracked chassis, or in fact, the team apparently had told him it was a cracked chassis, right? To make him feel better about being beaten by you.
Yeah.
You then took on the crack chassis and won the British Grand Prix with it. A new wing came to the team and there was one wing and two drivers and he was given the wing.
Yeah. Yeah.
When all these things happen again and again and again, and there'll be people listening to this that in their own workplace or in their own relationships with people, they feel they're in a kind of a similar position maybe to you. What were the mental tools that you came up with to deal with this?
Yeah, and, massive.
And how hard was it, I guess?
Yeah, really hard, you know, and that sounds like, oh, poor Mark, you know, you've rattled a lot of stuff off there, mate. But obviously it's really, really fine margin to think, you know, was there as much in that as I thought, or was there, you know, but ultimately you just sort of feel there could be a little bit of a tide here that you're slightly going against a couple of knots. You know, like if there's zero knots over there and you've got a couple of knots of stream against you, like this is just a little bit harder than it needs to be. And, mate, like I said, I didn't have the, you know, the most talent in the world, but I feel that there was parts of that, those things that you mentioned, like every now and again, I just thought, that is that really correct? I'm not quite sure.
So you're having self-doubt then as well.
Yeah, you're just like, and then that's energy, because you're just like, you know, you have to do a bit of admin in the background and sort of, you know, mop up a bit of stuff and say, is this right? Is this how it is? And, you know, so that's challenging. What mental tools do you use? I think that, you know, I turned it into fuel where I could for the fire, instead of saying, I just have to continue to do whatever I can to work with the tools I've got to keep swinging hard. I've got to just keep going. You know, if I show any signs of, you know, you could argue there were signs of weakness, but in terms of, you know, it was, you know, some of it got out into the media obviously at the time.
What, weakness
on
you?
You know, like, no, in terms of like, you know, not bad for number two driver or for, you know, for the wing stuff or, you know, so there were some explosions, you know, in terms of a bit of a crack at the team. But ultimately,
how good did it feel though when you said not bad for a number two driver? Did it feel good?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Well, and I had a one to say it the day before, but, you know, I had to wait another day until I won. But it was.
And did you feel like that?
Well,
number two driver.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I mean, that first part of 10, I just felt there was lots of things that were just like, you know, I had led the championship, and I'm just like, how is this, you know, give us a sniff, you know, instead of, you know, there was a gearbox penalty in Canada after I won Monaco, and it's like, this gearbox penalty, okay, this is interesting. And then at the end of that race, I caught Sebastian, I couldn't fight him. You know, it's like, well, I had the penalty, and now I want to pass him. It's like, no, we've got to call the race off. So anyway, there was, you know, mate, spilt milk, all that, whatever. But it's just at that point, you just feel a thing, you know, to answer your question, in a corporate setting, if you feel like you're, and there can be, of course, there can be, naturally, there can be politics in the corporate. Mm-hmm. So we know that, you know, if you feel you're giving the same effort and the same sort of performance, and there's someone else that's got some other different lane that they're operating in and sort of seem to be, you know, steaming through different sort of challenges you're dealing with, I think that ultimately you will know when enough is enough. Is this correct? Again, back to the gut feel. I was always on single year contracts at Red Bull, you know, which is, you know, again, that wasn't common knowledge for a long time, but until sort of at the end. But it was just like, again, it is what it was, you know, and we had a car at the front. We both were good for each other. So an employment factor, are you good for each other? You serve a purpose in that corporate setting. You know, how many cards do you have at the table to negotiate to change whatever you're not happy about? You know, what can you do to influence, to make yourself a little bit happy, to perform better in that role? Now, is it financial? Is it, you know, best working hours, or, you know, whatever it is, or you want some, you know, to report to someone different? You've obviously got to start to tick those off and pick them off tactically, what you feel is best for you. But your gut feel is generally pretty close, in my opinion, and patience. You got to be patient about, you know, hastily calls. I mean, I could have really trashed my own career several times, but I just needed to be a deep breath, patience, and
Was the lowest low point for you?
I think losing the championship in 10 was really hard. I think that was in Abu Dhabi, and I think, well, it was probably Singapore Monza time, where they were just keeping Seb back in the game, and we could have probably, Brazil, we could have shut it off even a bit earlier, because we kept Fernando. We were prepared to take the risk to probably lose it to Fernando and Lewis, or lose it to Fernando, than have both of us have a smaller chance instead of me having a bigger chance to do it. But that was like,
what, you go straight, you mean they would rather have Fernando have won a race than you?
No, the title. Like, right. A slim chance for Seb staying in it, then probably we're going to knock it on the head.
Than allowing the two of you to race and for you to have a real crack at it.
Yeah. So, and that was Brazil. I had a water pressure problem, whatever, at the end of the race. Like, okay, whatever. So it was, I mean, it was what it was. You know, it was at the time. It's 11 years ago now, so yeah, it's a while back. But it's still obviously a talking point, and it was a fascinating time in the team's learning curve.
But can I go back to that where you said I could have trashed my career several times, but I took a deep breath.
Mm.
Yep. I'm really intrigued by that, because it must have felt like easy to have spoke about your grievances.
I think the short fuse factor, mate, is a problem. So that the short fuse and knowing that you've got a big team of people behind you, and most of them absolutely have your best interests at heart, but you just, once it's out in the public environment, you know, it can be hard for you to pull it back in and patch that up. So of course, the people around me have been good at that in terms of making sure that, look, this is the big picture here, long game, and loyalty, you know. And look, at the end of that, I'm still with Red Bull now, like 14 years later. You know, yeah. The brand itself has been brilliant. The racing operations were certainly challenging for us. And in the end, you know, as Jake said.
What did you learn to get better at it? So what sort of tips did you, or techniques did you employ to get better at holding your tongue and gaining greater perspective?
Yeah, I think just what sort of tightrope you're on as a professional. I think that you realize that there's some big gaps, you know, and you're still relatively young, and you just feel, I think you're in such a bubble when you're a professional athlete, that there's still going to be infinite opportunities, you know, after that.
Right.
It's not the case. You've got to, like anything, you've got to continue to work hard at any other opportunities, whether it's in your career or post your career. You've got to really graft and find, because there's a lot of seriously good operators out there doing some really good stuff, and they're applying themselves brilliantly. You've got to be a bit clever and say, look, this is fighting for victories. Ultimately, the team environment is still something that I enjoyed. You know, it was still, you know, we had our flash points, but it was still something you like, you know, be careful. Don't bloody think it's always greener somewhere else, because it's very, very easy to be, you know, thinking it is, and you know, and you arrive at this new destination, and it's like, well, yeah, that house looks a bit different. It looks nice on the outside, but there's freaking no furniture.
There was a brilliant moment where you wrote a letter to the team, didn't you?
It depends who brilliant for who.
All right, interesting. A fascinating moment.
Yeah.
How was that received?
Very good from Dietrich, but horrible at Milton Keynes, yeah. So
then why would that be, though? Because obviously it wasn't a public letter. It wasn't shared with 400 members of staff.
Yeah.
It was just given directly to the people where it almost felt like that was
to the
you.
Boss. One guy.
So straight to one person.
Yeah, to the boss who paid my bills, yeah.
Why would that be badly received? Do you know what I mean by that, Damien? Because it's like all you want is honesty, and you want accountability, and you want openness, and you want truth from the people you employ. Yeah. I can totally understand if it was you'd held it up in the pit lane and said, hey, world's media, come and listen to this letter.
Wasn't an open letter.
I can get that.
Yeah.
But there were private letter to be badly received is it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I just think it probably put a bit of heat on people, you know, that were operationally, you know, sort of running the team at the time, and just Dietrich wanted answers. Well, I wanted answers, you know. So
what was the context of the letter?
It was just some of the operations of how, I suppose, the team was run at the time, and there was some challenging moments, again, within inter-team rivalry, and I just took it upon myself to, you know, write a letter to Dietrich, who's obviously the boss of all of us. He is the boss. And it was one letter that went to Austria, and he, of course, filtered it back down into senior management.
And they felt undermined, maybe, that you'd gone right to the top?
Yep. Well, I'd also played those cards earlier and probably didn't get the answer that I wanted, so I obviously went to the main man.
And what were you wanting to achieve there?
I suppose, mate, I just wanted to have him understand. Like, it made me feel better that, like, is this, you know, can you get better answers than I can? Is that possible? Is there other agendas here? You know, I just need more answers around certain topics. And he did as well in some ways, you know, because people listening to this, well, hang on, he's the boss, he should be across everything. This is a guy that's across, you know, Red Bull's a big organization, and the racing component was a huge facet of the business, but it was one facet, and he's not day-to-day inside the team. It's obviously other people, you know, running that. So he was just bringing them into question to say, you know, do we need to understand this a bit more? So, and that didn't go down well, obviously, with senior management whatsoever.
But when you look at your career, the best you drove and the best results and the moment you were at your peak was this period where you had your back against the wall and you felt like a number two driver and you felt like there wasn't equality or fairness.
Yeah.
And I think this is a really good reminder for people who are listening to this, that what isn't easy for you can still be good for you. And I think maybe you disagree with this. I think, looking at it from the outside, it was good for you to have your back against the wall, as painful as it was at times.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right, mate. I think I did enjoy the odds against me, but I think there was times where I felt like it was
too much.
Yeah, sometimes like, well, I got to shoulder this a bit more. Okay, that's, you know, nearly too much. And of course, it was all on me. It was no one else could actually shoulder that in terms of, you know, some of the things I had to deal with. But look, mate, this is not a Red Bull slagging. It's just a talking about, you know, cultures, employment, a member of a team, one member of a huge team. And I'm a better man for, you know, having driven in Formula One, having driven for Red Bull, all the scenarios. I believe I enjoy a good relationship with everyone to this day.
But it was good. I think it was good for you, like absolutely, it almost drew the best out of you.
Yeah, and absolutely. And it's not like the end of the day, we're not, you know, this is not lawn bowls, mate. Not anything against people out there play lawn bowls, but there was a lot at stake. And of course, with a lot at stake, there's going to be feathers ruffled every now and again, you know, and I was just had to be part of that. And, you know, and people, you know, again, mechanics or engineers or they're still to this day, some of those guys carry that, which is great, which is a good thing because that's how much it meant to all of us, you know, and the fine margins of top flight sport. So, you know, sometimes I'm out walking the dogs and I go, well, you know, look, you come from Queanbeyan, no sponsorship really whatsoever, had some good little support here and there along the way for some key individuals, which is pivotal, fluke some results when I really needed them. I was the wrong size for F1. I was always 9 kilos overweight because I couldn't lose any more weight. I was too tall. And all these things are just like, well, ultimately, mate, you know, you actually did do okay. You know, it's fine to look back, but you always, human nature is you always want more. Because I remember when I won my first race, that's it. Everyone else had a good day. There was no attrition. It was a fair victory, off pole, brilliant, absolutely stoked. That's it. Brilliant. And then Monday, you're like, wouldn't two be good? Yeah.
Human nature.
Yeah, yeah. And Valentino Rossi sent me one when I did win my second race. He goes, fantastic, two's a double of one. Yeah, that's human nature. We always want more. So, yeah.
And where are you at with it now mentally?
Very good, mate. Stoked. Very good. You know, more around the people I worked with, the journey I went on, whether it's with travel, whether it's the professional people I worked with, mate, would never, ever have happened if I didn't compete at that level. So I've been absolutely stoked with my career and perspective, I think, has also been good. You know, we've lost some mates in the, you know, racing, which has been tragic. You know, so you get this real, you know, the business side of it, the HR side of it. It's actually a very good sport in that sense, in terms of what it gave me. And it continues, you know, you still go around and people still love, they're saying, oh, we love watching your race, whether it's Brazil or Spain or, and that's nice because it's not about, it's a reflection of the sport. It's not a reflection of me as an individual. It's a reflection of actually car racing is still, people still love watching these gladiators or these, what they perceived as gladiators, things that they can't do. That's what sport should be. I love watching tennis. I love watching football. I love watching sports. And that's the best of the best. You just know that you can relate to it, but there's absolutely no way in the world that you could ever do it. And that's what my skill in the end was honed through working with phenomenal people. I'm blessed for that.
There was a lovely phrase, like my favourite phrase when I was reading about your career, Mark, was a quote from a BBC journalist that said, the best thing about you was that despite all the glamour and the glitz of Formula One and the career that you've had, that you remain completely unaffected by it. You're still the boy from
Queanbeyan,
From Queanbeyan.
Mm.
How did you keep your feet on the ground then?
The upbringing, I suppose. I think that, I don't know, rural Australia is, you know, it's you know, I'm not going to throw other people under the bus here, but I think I was just fortunate where I grew up. Look, I have got choices in my life now. Don't get me wrong. I can do things differently to what I, if I didn't race in Formula One, but I don't take that as, you know, I try to be, I just do what I do and people say that's nice to see.
You seem to operate on gut feel quite a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. If you're on a flight and someone wants a photo or autograph, you've got no idea what they're going through. No idea. And it's just nice if you can, it takes 5 seconds and it's just, if you can stay relatively, you know, look, I love the simple things in life, mate. I love riding my motorbike now. I love my dogs. And I don't need much at all to make me happy, which is great. I love a little log fire and, you know, a couple of mates. We have a couple of whiskeys and we're just like, I try to keep life pretty uncomplicated. I'm not that complicated because I had complications in terms of, as a professional, you've got to put a lot into it. And that was not easy for relationships. It was not easy for family. It was not easy for that, you know. And people talk about sacrifices is a word that I hate. Oh, I made all these sacrifices. Well, you know, for me, it was all upside. You know, people say, oh, you did so well with all these sacrifices. I mean, it's bullshit because you've got to step up. And this is, you know, for me, it was all like, this is all upside. Every single thing, if I nail this, it's not a sacrifice. It's like, you know, it was just something that needed to be done.
But also, it's about living a really interesting life. You know, you didn't have to raise sponsorship and deal with all those sponsors as a young driver to get into F1. You got to.
Mm.
You didn't have to deal with all the politics at Williams and Red Bull and in the overall Formula One world. You got to do that. Yeah. You didn't have to go toe-to-toe with a world champion. You got to. Yeah. It's about realising that among all the challenges that exist in life, and we can all look at everything in our lives as a challenge, or look at all as an opportunity.
Yeah. That's right, mate. You know, possibilities, not problems, in terms of, you know, finding the way to be positive. You know, there's always, as you say, there's currents and little headwinds that come along. That's life. Look, what is wealthy? Is wealthy money, or wealthy with family, or wealth, like, how is wealth measured? But people that have a tremendous amount of finance behind them, you know, there's a lot out there that aren't overly happy with their life, you know, because there's whatever it is. They've had baggage from the past, or wrong decisions, or now it's, you know, perceptions, or, you know, and there's a lot of cracking individuals that have kicked a lot of goals and they're still true to themselves, which is awesome. So you're right, mate. Having that just the fullness, the life, the ups and downs, seeing the little uppercuts, getting back up, and that makes you feel, you know, feel good. And giving back a bit, mate, like that makes me feel, you know, I've done some stuff in Australia which I'm proud of, and whether it's building some units for some kids with leukemia that are rural based, can't have their siblings and family support them because they're from rural areas, and having the units close by to the clinics makes you feel mega. Are we banging the drums about it? No, but that is something where you feel, they're just a little snippet of, makes me feel good.
And how happy are you?
Very, mate. Very happy now. I mean, it's been tricky times, hasn't it? COVID has been really interesting for all of us in terms of the cadence of how we used to operate before, whether it's, you know, catching up with friends and doing things and family. And I suppose what I'm saying is that this is like an injury for some people. Like, you take for granted when you're healthy, you know, and now we've all had a little bit of an injury. And it's like, well, actually, before that, now I probably took for granted certain things that actually I could just have at the drop of a hat very, very easily. And now you're going to come out maybe at the other end and sort of, you know, re-juggle things a little bit, what's important, even down to maybe where I live, even down to some of my work rate, my time that I spend with people that I want to really love being with, and really enjoy the smaller things that maybe, you know, pre-COVID was just on tap, if you like. So, mate, for me, the recreational component of my life is very important. I love sometimes even being on my own. I'll go on the motorbike for 10 days and just hit the Alps or Scotland or whatever, you know, and that makes me feel, I enjoy that, the planning, and, you know, I think there's some power in being happy with yourself and just going out and doing those things alone. So, but obviously Annie and I, we do some great things together, and yeah, it's enjoyable.
So can I ask you about Anne? I mean, apart from being a class act because she's a United fan, the bit I'm interested in is that she's been both your manager and your wife.
Yep.
And I'm interested in how you manage that
dangerous
those
combo,
two relationships.
Mate. Dangerous combo, yeah. There's been some testing moments around the commercial situation and the private stuff in terms of just, I mean, stuff that she's encouraging you to do. And of course, you know, I mean, we rarely argue, very rarely do we argue, but sometimes it's around, not now, because obviously my days are over in terms of most of the decisions we make now are fun, and we're getting into things with our eyes wide open. We enjoy doing that. But like before, it was like, for example, like the Australian Grand Prix, all these, you know, requests coming in, and she's obviously the bad cop to the team, and sort of, you know, and I don't want to do this and don't want to do that. And it's like, well you need to. You know, you're just, well, you know, and then it's like, and all of a sudden, you know, it flares up, and it's like, you know, you're having arguments about, you know, the professional side and how, you know, the brand, you know, what she's been so good on in terms of understanding that and the longevity, you know, after my career of sort of having a good vision and perspective on how that should look. That's been brilliant. But, you know, we're now, crikey, 1996 or something. So it's been a while been together. And, she's been brilliant. Looks a spade, mate. She didn't take much shit. But, it's brilliant, and been a good little duo. Lean, mean machine in terms of our team has been very small for our whole career.
Was that important to you, just to have a very small unit of people you really trust?
Yeah, I think so, mate. And also didn't just overcomplicate things. So we didn't need, you know, I mean, now there's obviously all these experts in life and experts in, you know, in terms of, you know, with social media and all. Thankfully, that wasn't around in my time and agencies and all the rest of it. But and you need them. Look, okay, there's space for some of that, of course. But, you know, we kept it pretty simple, mate. And it wasn't rocket science, mate. I just drove around circles for a living, you know. And I work with the best people and some of the biggest brands in the world. And I wanted to over-deliver for those people as best I could. You know, as I say, always did what I gave the best performance of myself every single time I tried to to work in that environment. And even small things like Blesser, like, you know, when the simulators come online here in the UK, you know, the simulator, we did huge hours in those, and it was like sometimes like, you know, packing a lunchbox. It was like, you know, off to school pretty much, you know, like, you know, big day of work. And it's like, even down to those little things, it's like, yeah, she was brilliant with that stuff.
Brilliant. We've reached the point in our interview where we do our quick fire questions at the end. Before we get to them though, do you reflect on everything we've discussed, that whole career, and think you gave it the absolute maximum every time?
Yeah. Look, I think that, again, back to that, oh, do you want more? What could we have done better? You're more knowledgeable now in many ways. Ignorance is bliss. You know, naivety is bliss, because then you've got the enthusiasm. If you said at the end of your career, you're going to have to do what you're going to have to do to get, like, probably not. You know, it's going to be, you know, if you don't know what's coming, you just got to, it makes you have that lust for what's down the road. But I think the experience curve against the sort of naivety curve, and you're sort of like, you know, if I had more,
yeah,
you know, the old
would you change anything then if you could go back, or do you not operate like that?
I think just, again, probably more into the details. Like, I was into the details, but I think sometimes I used to put a bit of a test on myself to say, I'll work that out, not on the fly, but I like to sort of have that instinct and dealing with things, not in a reckless way at all, and being ridiculous with it. But could I have been more detailed? Maybe. But, you know, there was a lot of tools around to get into some of that stuff at the time. Could I have done more with that? But it's only now you see how much they do. But at the time, it was in its infancy. So, you know, should I have thought more about using different tools and challenge that segment more to help my performance? Could have done. But, you know, is what it was, mate.
Right then, quick fire questions. What are the three non-negotiable behaviours that you and the people around you have to buy into?
Timekeeping,
yep.
Consistency, and enthusiasm.
What advice would you give a teenage Mark just starting out?
Be truthful to the mirror.
If you could go back to any point in your life, where would you go and why?
Crikey, Jake, that's brutal, mate. Like that, you know. I think, you know, driving 2010, like those cars through there, when I was absolutely at the peak of my career, that was a beautiful moment.
How important is legacy to you, Mark?
Not overly important. I think people can look at what you've achieved, but I think that, you know, people will find their own way. There's a lot more important people than whatever my legacy will ever be, so they can look at those legacies instead of mine.
This is kind of the final message, really, to people that have listened to this. What would you leave them with as your one golden rule to living a high-performance life?
Surround yourself with people that continue to get more out of you. It doesn't matter what you've achieved. There's always someone out there, I think, that can squeeze a bit more out of you, and you can always do more than you think you can.
Perfect. Mark, thank you very much for your time.
No worries.
Damien.
Jake.
It was an interesting chat with Mark, wasn't it? Obviously, I was working on Formula One when he was in that real era where things were pretty heated between him and Sebastian Vettel, and to sit there now and hear him talk about it in retrospect, I just get the impression that it was definitely really difficult for him, probably really difficult for quite a few years, but he almost, as we said to each other as we left, he feels like he's found some freedom, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think if it's possible to have a lifestyle envy of anyone, I think it was definitely the sense of freedom, the liberation that he's got of being happy with what he's done, but not resting on his laurels, being in the moment, the now, as he said.
And you know how I talk about my parents giving us the two important things in life, roots and wings?
Yep.
I think the fact that his mum and dad gave him those roots to Queanbeyan is really important to him, because it feels like that is a mad world to go into and to be on a really, really public stage, and to be up against it at the time when you're also at your very best is so difficult. And I do sense that it was a reminder of where he came from that almost kept him sane through that period. And I think that's probably a really healthy thing for all of us, just to have in our heads, like, the journey we've been on, rather than getting somewhere thinking, right, what's next? It is a really important reminder of, hold on, let's just remember how far I've come.
Yep, absolutely. And I think the values that he's described his parents had instilled in him, like giving the best in every moment, leave nothing on the plate, you know, just put yourself out there at all times, with the values that he kept coming back to even when he was having those difficult relationships.
And you know, like, when you talk about values, you get people that, and we've seen them and we won't name them, they'll come on the podcast and they'll say a certain thing, but you'll see a different behaviour from them either before or after the recording. But the reality is, we turn up with Mark, who wants a cup of tea, come on in, he's lit a fire for us, you know, that he's a genuine person. And even the way that he kind of talks, like, he doesn't even pretend to have all the answers. Whereas some people are obsessed with having to have the answers all the time. Whereas I think with him, it's just like, this is what I experienced. This is what I feel about it. If it's helpful for some people listening to your podcast, great. If it isn't, sorry. That's, yeah. He's totally honest and just, it's all out there, isn't it? There's no side to him.
Yeah, and I think that's where that freedom, that liberation comes from, that there's nothing he's hiding. He's just a man completely at peace with himself, and that's where the envy, the lifestyle envy comes from.
And it's probably a hard one, actually, for him to think about. But I do honestly believe that the fact that he felt that Sebastian Vettel was getting a different service to him, and the fact that the media of the world weren't seeing the true story, and the fact that he had challenges with the management of the team he was racing for. I do honestly think that all of that actually got the best out of him. And I feel that if he wasn't in that situation, I wonder whether he would have fought as hard and then been as successful.
Well, there's lots of people that we've interviewed that are better as challengers rather than being the champions. Being the champion affords you a comfort, a luxury, a lifestyle. Whereas when you're the challenger, you're striving for it, your back's against the wall. And I think there's some people that do respond to that, and Mark would definitely fit in that category.
He's a good honest Aussie, right?
Yeah, brilliant bloke.
Hey Damien, are you ready for one of the most enjoyable parts of every episode from our perspective?
I love this bit. Yep, looking forward to it.
Come on then. Let's say hello to Howie and Ryan. How you doing, guys?
Thanks for having us.
Nice to see you both. Right, come on. I need to know the story now, because for the first time we have two high-performance listeners joining us towards the end of the podcast to share their experience. So what is going on?
Well, me and Ryan, we know each other from school. And we were both in both industries that were quite affected during the pandemic. So Ryan was working on the cruise ships as a dancer. I was working as a cabin crew in the airline industry. So suddenly our worlds were, you know, changed quite dramatically. And we were in a bit of a transition period. So I came back home and he came back home, and we had a bit of time to think and what we're going to do with our time. And the Barista Bros, the coffee mobile business, was formed.
Yeah, it's a very odd thing. I actually messaged Howie because I had an idea about starting this coffee business, and he went, "Shut up, that's exactly what I'm thinking of doing." So then ended up, obviously, two mates in lockdown together having a Zoom call, as everyone did in the world, with a beer in our hand, and created this. I wouldn't say business plan. Let's not put that two together. But we had a conversation, and now we're doing it.
So why coffee?
Well, Howie's been in coffee for a fair few years now, which I'm sure he'll tell you more about. And if I'm being completely honest, I love the taste of coffee. So the combination of the both worked quite well. And from a business perspective as well, the main thing that everyone was doing in lockdown was going for a walk and grabbing a coffee.
And the strangest point how this all came together was Ryan's sister had the horse books that we use today. And I was thinking about going and starting my own and going in coffee because it's something I'd done before. So I started researching, maybe converting a van, and randomly Ryan messaged me one day saying, "I'm thinking about doing this, buying my sister's horse box and making coffee out of it. You know a bit about that? Can I use some of your time?" And I said, "Hold on, I'm thinking that. How about we join my knowledge and, you know, your can do, and you've got the horse box, and we put it together."
Brilliant. Now, this is a brilliant story. I love entrepreneurial spirit. I love people doing something different. I love you being brave and leaving the comfy chair to pursue this sort of thing. One thing I'm not aware of yet, though, is why on earth the High Performance Podcast figures in this story, where it figures, how it figures. What's the deal here?
Yeah, well, I actually stumbled across you guys when you first started and fell in love with the podcast. I thought it was excellent. And I know that Howie loves this kind of thing as well. So it was actually the Johnny Wilkinson episode that caught my attention particularly. And A, it was phenomenal, but B, I thought Howie needs to have a listen to this. So, and I don't think I've ever done this, but I just randomly messaged him and was like, "You need to listen to this."
Seven times I've watched that Johnny Wilkinson, listen to that one.
So what is it then about our podcast that grabbed you both? Why did you, because listening to one episode, fine, but then carrying on, listening to more, sharing it, talking about it. I'm so interested in why people keep on coming back for more.
I think personally, Johnny Wilkinson episode, I'm quite sporty. I play football, and it grabbed me my attention. Then I started watching, listening to some of the other episodes, and it was people that I'd never imagined that I'd be listening to that was grabbing my attention and taking me down on paths and learning about where they came from and how they started and the problems they've had. And I'm honest, some things I don't take from everyone, but it's the little snippets I take from every episode I listen to, and I go, that's the bit I like, that's the bit that helps me.
So what's been the most powerful one then, Howie? What the most powerful lesson that you've taken away?
I think Susie Marr, Infinite Purpose. I go through my day-to-day and I just go to the next bit, to the next bit, but I've never really thought about my infinite purpose. What is my purpose further than my coffee business, further than that? And I think actually then that helps in your day-to-day life and everything you do, not just my coffee business. It's what's the whole.
So what's your infinite purpose then?
For me, it's how can I bring joy to other people every single day? And just over a cup of coffee, that's what we can do. And it's amazing. And it goes further than that, you know, it's day to day. But through our business, not only can we serve great coffee, local, but we can serve it with a smile and have a quick chat. And that little energy I can pass on, and that customer can take it to the next person. And suddenly my infinite purpose is not just staying in that box, the coffee box, it's going on further.
Lads, I bloody love this, and I wish you all the very best for 2022. Just tell people where they can find a bit more information about you.
So we're on Facebook and we're on Instagram, the Barista Bros Coffee. And if you're local to the West Sussex area, then come down and grab a coffee at the Dragon. But we do move around, so come and check our socials out for where we're going.
It's always good, isn't it, Damien, to hear from listeners, particularly a couple of guys who've kind of totally rewritten the way their lives look after a pandemic, and with a little bit of guidance from High Performance. And there's been loads of questions pinging into us this week. Let me ask you one here. This is from SammyP123 on Instagram. Asks, what's the biggest pitfall people have when failing to achieve high performance? I mean, that's a good one for you, Damien.
Yeah, I think not anticipating the messy middle. So I know it's a theme that we talk about regularly, Jake, but people not anticipating that things go wrong, you get far enough in that you can't see the end, you're too far to go back, morale declines. That happens to everybody on any high performance journey. So again, one of the big lessons we've learned from this is prepare for things to go wrong. You know, the most important part of any plan is planning for that plan not to go to plan, is a nice way of phrasing it.
Yeah, that's nice. And there's a question that's come in from Jake_Hartley, who says, what's the biggest takeaway from the podcast that you've both implemented into your lives? I think there's two for me. The first one is Memento Mori, which is Latin for remember death, which sounds morbid, but actually Damien is the total opposite of morbid, because it's about knowing that we all effectively have a terminal diagnosis. There's no one on this earth that's going to live forever. So therefore, every minute of every day and every decision you make, you have to make with the mindset that there isn't a second to lose. And if you were told you're going to die tomorrow, how would you live today? Trying to live as close to that as is kind of realistically possible. And the other one from Susie Marr, Infinite Purpose, which is really where high performance comes in, living a purposeful life. What about you, Damo?
Well, that Memento Mori, just to interrupt for a second, Jake, is it was an actual position as well that the more far-sighted Roman emperors used to appoint somebody in. So it's easy when you're in a position like that, that you're often compared to a god in those days, that you get high on your own supply. And the more far-sighted emperors used to have someone that would remind them of their fallibility and their very human nature, so that it stopped them getting carried away with their own importance. I think from my point of view, I think it's about 360 feedback, getting regular feedback from people that are really important to you in your world. So people that understand the journey that you're on and can give you really valuable feedback. So in the case of doing this, you know, yourself, Will, Finn, and the team that can often come and give some real valuable insights. Incredible for our own development, whatever we're doing.
Yeah, it's brilliant. A message from Simon Beasley asking, is there going to be a high performance store? And if so, what can we get our hands on? Yes, there is going to be a high performance store. It is on its way. And we're going to have some great merchandise, t-shirts, hoodies, bags, all sorts of things for you. So watch this space for that. And then quite a lot of people, actually, Damien, four or five people this week asking if we really believed the impact that High Performance was going to have when we started. And I guess it's on the week when tickets have gone on sale for the High Performance Tour in 2022, and they are, I mean, there's hardly any left now. We had a sellout event in Manchester talking about our book, which also goes on sale on Thursday, and the store's on its way, and the numbers have been amazing, because this week everyone on Spotify has been sharing how they've been listening to the podcast, and we had a 500% increase in terms of followers and listeners and downloads and things. So did we ever think it would get this far? I would actually say, Damien, obviously no, but also that I'm not in a, I don't want this to come out the wrong way for people listening to this, I'm really not that bothered, if this makes sense, because we just spoke about just doing the right thing, kind of making this podcast as purposeful as possible. So therefore, it was never about getting to a certain place or achieving a certain thing. It was just about the quality of the conversations.
Yeah.
So we didn't, because we still don't. If
I'm 100%, if, yeah.
I don't want to offend people by saying yeah. that. Do you know what I mean? Like, we don't care that we're successful, but there is an element of that, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I don't, because that's outside our control. We can't influence that. I mean, when we hear the guys just then talking about phoning each other up and saying you need to listen to this podcast, it's incredibly kind and humbling, but that's outside our control. That's nothing to do with us. The only bits we can focus on is turning up and doing the best job we can with the guests that we're lucky enough to speak to, and if that resonates with people, that's fantastic and fulfilling, but that's not our concern.
Very interesting. Before we go any further, Damon, we also just want to mention a young man who has lived through incredible personal tragedy, but is doing something pretty special at the moment to raise awareness, raise funds, and have a positive impact in the face of adversity, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. We want to talk about Charlie Starmer Smith here, and the single that he's released called Spotlight. His own life has been touched by dementia, as mine has as well, so it's a cause that I feel quite passionate around. And I think for him to do this in the face of the grief and the difficult circumstances of his own story is incredible, and it's great that we can point people in Charlie's direction.
You're absolutely right, Damien. And if you want to find out more about Charlie's story, then you can just search for him online. And you can also download his song Spotlight as well, which he's written. And it was played on the BBC. It rocketed up the iTunes charts actually the other day. And anything you can do to support him, send him a message of positivity, download the song, whatever it is, please do, because he's a guy trying to make a real difference in the face of real difficulties. So Charlie, I hope that 2022 is a good one for you, and from all of us here at High Performance, we're sending you our very best. Damien, thanks a lot, mate.
Thanks, Jake, loved it as always.
Another interesting episode. Thanks to Faye Lawrence from Rethink Audio for her hard work on the High Performance podcast. Thanks as well to Hannah, to Will, and to Eve for bringing so much to the party as well, but most of all, thanks to you. Remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. Be your own biggest cheerleader. Make world-class basics your calling card, because you deserve them. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.